My name is Karen Katowski. I'm a retired Lieutenant Colonel, United States Air Force. I served 20 years and 2 months and retired effective 1 July 2003. And my last position, I worked in Office of Secretary of Defense, Undersecretariat for Policy. When I first joined that office in the year 2000, I worked in the Sub-Saharan Africa office, and then I was drafted to join the Near East South Asia office, which is a sister division underneath policy. And that's also the location of the Office of Special Plans, the Iraq desk, and that kind of thing. My formal duties were the North Africa portfolio, and I worked there from May of 2002 until February of 2003.
And what was the circumstances of your leaving your work there?
Like I said, I was drafted from a sister office in May of 2002. They had a shortage of personnel in the Near East South Asia office. They put a call out for volunteers. They didn't get any volunteers, so they brought in non-volunteers from other divisions. So that's how I joined them. And I had spent some amount of time in trying to make sure that my duty there would be very short-term and not permanent, and that I would return back to Sub-Saharan Africa. But that didn't really work out. So by August, I realized I was going to be in that office until I retired. So that was where I was. But then in the fall of 2002, and some stuff during the summer of 2002 as well, right when I began working with Near East South Asia, but particularly in the fall, I observed things that I didn't agree with, that I didn't think were correct, that I didn't think were ethical, and mainly this had to do with the propagandizing of the effort to convince Americans that we needed to go into Iraq, to invade Iraq, or, and do a regime change. The convincing was not required amongst the senior civilian leadership in the Pentagon. They already knew that was what they were going to do. But all the desk officers and the other folks that worked in policy and elsewhere in the government, but particularly what I saw in policy, if they were useful to the propaganda effort, if they had something to contribute there, then that's what they would be expected to do. And otherwise, you know, just go and do your job and don't worry about it. But I observed this kind of use or misuse of intelligence and data, and I was very alarmed at some of the speeches that were given by the president and the vice president last fall. And given the other things that I'd seen within the workings of the Pentagon, particularly the neoconservative leanings of basically most of the senior civilians there, it became very upsetting to me. And at that point, I determined that I would try to retire as soon as I could. I did move my retirement date up a couple of months. Now, the specific circumstances of my leaving in February of 2003 had to do with, I can tell you the story, I'll try to make it kind of short. Our deputy director had sent out to all of us in the Near East South Asia office, a variety of desk officers, probably about 12 or 13 people, a State Department cable or message that was responding to about 51 questions that the country of Turkey had asked America regarding the, you know, upcoming invasion and also the aftermath, planning for the aftermath in Iraq. And of course, Turkey obviously was being wooed by us as far as facilities, and Turkey being a neighbor had some very specific concerns about what might be happening, what kind of chaos might be unleashed and what that would mean for Turkey. So they had these 51 questions. And the answers to those questions, for the most part, they were military-type questions, security-type questions, operational-type questions, and those had been answered and had been prepared, apparently. It was clear to me they had been prepared by the Pentagon, because they were Pentagon and security and defense-related questions, passed the state, and then state put this together in terms of answers. And our deputy director sent this cable out, questions and answers, to all of us as an information copy, and he said, this might be helpful to you. There's some good stuff here. A lot of us who weren't working Iraq directly had many questions about what was going on. So he thought this would be helpful, and so I was eager to get it, and I read through this. And at the end of the 51 questions and 51 answers, it was clear to me, based on the number of to be determined, or we haven't really thought about that yet, or we'll handle that when it happens, or that's not going to happen. When I saw the number of answers to those very legitimate questions that were in that category, I sent an email back on the secure system to my boss, just to him, my deputy director. It was a sarcastic email, and I said, if this is as good as it gets this late in the game, this was February, I said, there's going to be some folks who may be sitting right beside Saddam Hussein in the war crimes tribunals. Now, that was stated that sarcastically, but the point was there, basically, that it was criminal the lack of planning this late in the game that was apparent. And he, at that point, called me down when he got that email and said, look, if you feel this strongly about what it is that we're doing here in this office, you probably shouldn't be here because we're going to go to war any time now. And it's probably not a good place for you to be. And I said, I agree with you. And so I moved back to my other office for about 6 more weeks, which some of that time was out processing for retirement, which had been scheduled already. But that's my story.
Did you expect that type of reaction from your boss?
Well, if I had known it would have been that easy to go back to sub-Saharan Africa, I would have done it a lot earlier. I didn't think that it would be an issue, and I'll tell you why. I had expressed my concerns in a number of ways prior to that, verbally, through some emails, not like the specific one that I sent him on in response to this specific cable, but I had expressed my concerns. I had been in conversations with the deputy director. Of course, I think everyone that worked with me in that office understood where I stood. And where I stood was, as a conservative, as a traditional conservative, the imperialism, the neoconservative ideology, the very much unleashing of chaos as a strategy that's very inconsistent with either traditional conservatism or with military thinking. This is not how we do. That's not how the military tends to do business. You know, well, we'll just unleash chaos and see what happens. That's not how Tommy Franks did as well as he did in that invasion. It's not how the military succeeds. We just don't do that. So it was inconsistent to me, the leadership, the civilian leadership in particular in the Pentagon, with my values, and I expressed that verbally. I had a funny cartoon set of newspaper clippings of both articles and cartoons behind my desk, and people would come back there to see what was new. I had probably 10 or 20 different little things, and most of them poked fun at the war planning, or they were articles, critical articles that I printed from the Early Bird, basically our news clipping service at the Pentagon. So, you know, it was stuff that we were all reading, but I would put it up on my wall, I think, to send a message, and people liked to come back there. Most people that knew me, while some didn't, I mean, I don't think they all agreed with my perception of what was happening, but most of them appreciated where I was coming from and saw the logic there. I mean, like I said, military, our strategies are not, why don't we just blow stuff up and see what happens? That's not how the military does business. And that's how I perceived and observed the planning to be happening from the senior civilian level. And this would be Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Mr. Feiss, and then there was a significant role that I observed and kind of gathered of the Office of the Vice President.
Can you tell us what the difference is between the Office of Policy and the Office of Special Plans? How does the OSP stand out as being different from Office of Policy?
Mm-hmm. Well, first off, Doug Feiss runs policy as an Undersecretary of Defense for policy. He's one of four, well, they made another one, so he's one of five undersecretaries that report directly to Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld. So he's got probably 800 to 1,000 folks. I'm not sure how big policy is, but it's a very large organization. And then under the undersecretary, you have deputy undersecretaries of defense, and you have deputy assistant secretaries of defense, and they divide up the world. So Near East South Asia initially was a deputy assistant secretary of defense position. So we work for Mr. Feiss, which is policy, all of policy. I think the difference between Office of Special Plans technically was announced and formulated as the expanded Iraq desk in the summer of 2002. It wasn't really announced at that time, but they had hired on a lot of extra people in the summer of 2002, and in about August time frame, there was no more space for them. They found new spaces on the fifth floor of the Pentagon, not too far away from where we were, and then those folks moved out and moved upstairs. And about a month or so after they moved out, there was a formal duty title change made for Dr. Bill Luddy, who had originally been the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Near East South Asia. Now he was the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, which is a kind of a promotion, for Near East South Asia and Special Plans. And at that point, it was kind of announced. Now, that's my experience that's my exposure to the Office of Special Plans. However, long before this, shortly after 9/11 in 2001, there was some people working for Rumsfeld, and I mean, this was well reported in the media. I think Dr. Cambone was one of them, and there were some other folks that were looking at intelligence. Sometimes they're called special plans. My exposure to it was when they took out the expanded Iraq desk, and they took some Iran folks too later, and moved them upstairs. That was announced formally as Office of Special Plans. However, most of the folks that worked there were civilians who had come from other parts of the Pentagon. So it's possible that they had been in the Pentagon working this kind of thing ahead of time, but since there was no space in NISA, you know, we didn't see those folks on a routine basis. It was definitely a big office of special plans. You know, the military folks that I'm aware of had come from where I worked. They were desk officers. But the civilians, I'm not sure where they all came from. I mean, the guy in charge was Abe Schulsky. I think he had been in the Pentagon, or at least working on Pentagon things, long before they moved up to the fifth floor in August of 2002. So I'm not really clear on all that, but that's, you know, one of the complications.
Would it be fair to say that the bulk of people working there that were brought in were civilians and not people with military experience?
Well, they were definitely civilians. The bulk of the folks upstairs working off the special plans were definitely civilians, and they were definitely from outside of the Pentagon. Some were contractors, some were political appointees. I think Abe Schulsky's a political appointee. There were two Air Force colonels, the two Army lawyers on the side, and then there was a civil service DIA loan officer who was up there. There may have been others, but I know of at least one. And he happened to be a former Air Force captain and was in the reserve, a major in the Air Force Reserve. So those folks had military experience, if you want to look at it that way. But in the terms of the rest of the folks and the leadership of that office, Abe Schulsky obviously is an academic for his entire career, a number of those folks were not people with military experience. There were some contractors, and I know several of them, not a whole lot of them, but several of them, who were retired military officers, some of a senior rank. They weren't totally devoid of military experience, but one of the clear factors of working in that office and being productive in that office was an ideological bent of basically the neoconservative storyline, which you can read anywhere on the internet, but it's in the Project for a New American Century has documents that outline how they view radical reformation of the Middle East, and that pretty much was the ticket for civilians that worked there. They were ideologically aligned. There was no question in their mind that what they were doing, invasion of Iraq as an initial foray into the Middle East, is a stepping off point for other activities in the Middle East that we would be initiating and influencing as the United States. This was the ticket. If you, for some reason, disagreed with that, did not share that view, you would not be working up there, and I think that's basically kind of the cliquishness of that function. And, you know, when you... I wrote an editorial that was picked up by a number of papers back in July, and I criticized the Pentagon for, particularly the Office of Special Plans, for a couple of things. One is cliquishness. Another one is groupthink, which goes with the cliquishness kind of thing, that when you only work with your friends and they pretty much say, hey, you look great, you look great, you look great, no matter what. And the other thing was a cutting off of information and free exchange and engagement with the professional side of either the Pentagon or the State Department or other parts of government. These folks that came in were not interested in what Defense Department long-term experienced professionals in the region had to say. They were not interested in what the State Department had to say, and I think that's pretty open and out in the open. But they weren't interested in what anyone had to say, including people who had spent their lives studying the region and understanding the factors and ramifications and all these things. It wasn't that they were just shut out. The positions that these people might have brought to the table were not welcome. They were not welcome. They were not asked for. And because of those kinds of things, the clique that they had, that they brought in from the outside and put in place there to work the Middle East issues, the groupthink that goes with the cliquishness, and the fact that they cut themselves off from any rationalizing or logical, fair-minded input from the State Department, from other parts of the Pentagon, including the military, but I'm thinking primarily of professional civilians. Because they did those things, guess what? They screwed up quite a bit, made a lot of assumptions that weren't valid. Those poor assumptions that have got us to where we are today with a lot of dead people on both sides and no end in sight, those assumptions could have been prevented by a process that is actually nothing more than the normal process. They brought in a different process, and that process has resulted in what you see today in Iraq.
And that's because the White House itself pretty much exclusively took the information coming from them as gospel?
What seems to have happened, and I know in the Office of Special Plans, Dr. Luddy had formerly worked for Dick Cheney. He'd also worked for Newt Gingrich. We had another former Newt Gingrich staffer, and Newt Gingrich sat on the Defense Policy Board along with Richard Perle. This cluster of people, talk to each other very closely, and that includes Scooter Libby and the Office of the Vice President. Scooter was referred to as Scooter in staff meetings, and I didn't know who they were talking about when I first heard him, because where I worked in sub-Saharan Africa, there would be no concept of ever working directly with the Office of the Vice President. So there was definitely a familiarity between Ludi and the Office of Special Plans and the Vice President's office. What seems to have happened as far as the bad intelligence is that, you know, we have the traditional intelligence process that produces vetted intelligence. Say somebody walks into the embassy, you know, in Africa somewhere. They walk into the South African embassy and they say, hey, I have some information. And they report it and say the CIA guy or the DIA guy there will take this information down and he will write up a report. Here's a guy that came in on such and such a date. He told me these things. And they send that report up the chain, and where it is compared with other information that the intelligence community has, it is assessed for validity and accuracy and all these other things. The system does that. And then at the end, there's an intelligence report that's produced and shared with all of the customers of the intelligence community. And that's a vetted intelligence report. That's something that you can at least be sure has been looked at by a number of different people in a fairly objective and rational way. Now, what seems to have happened is that Ahmed Jalabi and his people in the Iraqi National Congress and other people that they knew would work closely, and they did work closely. I mean, Jalabi came to the office, and one time he was pointed out to me, and I know he'd been there other times as well. And there were meetings in Washington with Ahmed and his people conducted by the Office of Special Plans, some of the folks in the Office of Special Plans. And what seems to have happened is that information that might have been garnered or gained or offered by Jalabi or Jalabi's people or friends of Jalabi's people was, instead of being sent as raw intelligence, just like the walk-in at the South African embassy might have been, instead of treated like that, sent back to the intelligence community and no action taken until a validated, vetted intelligence assessment is made of that information, what seems to have happened is that that information was sent directly over to speechwriters, certainly speechwriters, in the Office of the Vice President. I can't verify that that's exactly what happened, but that's certainly what seems to have happened. Because, as you know, after the fact, this summer, George Tenet has published national intelligence assessments that kind of show where the full picture on the intelligence, where there were a number of dissenting offices that had issues and concerns that would have provided some perspective on the intelligence. All that was left out, but it was there. So it seems like the information that was gained, any information that was gained at the Office of Special Plans, was passed and treated as if it was validated intelligence, when in fact it was not validated intelligence. That's the only thing that I can conclude based on some of the crazy stuff that's happened.
Yeah, it seems odd that the CIA, that to my understanding had a hand in the formation of the Iraqi National Congress, and they were saying that the information coming out of Jalabi and the INC was pretty weak.
Yes, and unreliable. Yeah, that's true. And they would have known, having worked with Jalabi for many years, almost a decade, they would have certainly been in a far better position to assess Jalabi and the Iraqi National Congress's ability to provide valid information. And in fact, the DIA and CIA had pretty much, and State Department certainly, had cut Jalabi out of as a valid source. And they had been burned just too many times. Too many times his information was bad. You know, you don't keep going for this bad stuff. Pretty soon you make a decision. And you say, well, I don't think I need to waste my time. And that's pretty much the assessment of the major intelligence assessors at State and CIA and DIA. But Jalabi had some friends left, and one of them was Bill Ludi, and the other one was Dick Cheney. And I think Doug Feist got on with them all right. But certainly the neoconservatives found Jalabi to be an ideal person. Why, I don't know. I guess we really didn't want democracy in Iraq, but we wanted Jalabi in Iraq. I'm not sure. But we'd certainly like to have our own guy. America's tradition is not to not have your own guy in there. I mean, certainly. I mean, that's why we have Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was backed by the CIA all those years ago. Osama bin Laden, backed by the CIA all those years ago. You always like to have your own guy if you can. But yeah, Jalabi had very narrow access into policy circles, but one of those points was Office of Special Plans, and through them, or directly, the other point was Office of Vice President.
Did you catch the press conference that Ludi and Feith did back in June when they were trying to recover from the media coverage of the OSP?
You know, I may have seen it, but it's not ringing a bell.
Douglas Feith had said that one of the main reasons they came out with the press conference, that it was his idea and it was to counteract the urban legend that was coming up around the Office of Special Plans.
What was his idea?
I believe at the time the press was, several accounts were saying that the OSP had, in fact, was the driving force behind the concept of weapons of mass destruction being in Iraq.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and he said, and Feist said it was him and not the Office of Special Plans?
No, he was saying it wasn't them. That,
oh, it wasn't them. Well, who
wasn't
was it?
I don't know. He didn't say that.
Well, it was them because they needed that in order to convince the American people and to make them scared and to make them feel that the link with terrorism, WMD and all that, and Saddam and Osama all in alliance. I mean, this stuff is all false, patently false. The president himself has said it's not true. Of course, he didn't say it last year wasn't true. Last year he was saying it every time he gave a speech. But now he says, oh, no, that's not true. We know that there was no linkage between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. We already knew we weren't going to find that many WMDs. We certainly, now we're looking for programs, and we're probably not going to find those. And now the president says that. Last fall, he wasn't saying that at all. He's talking about mushroom clouds and 45 minutes and UAVs with weapons on them. It's part of a propaganda thing. We've been had. American people have been had. And anybody with sons, daughters, nephews, and nieces in Iraq ought to be extremely angry about it. The neocons had an agenda. Their agenda includes Iran and Syria. Unfortunately, things went so bad in the aftermath of Iraq that they have to put on hold some of the Syria and Iran-type issues. But, you know, they knew why they wanted to go to Iraq. The reason that we have all these stories that we've been told, including what the president and the vice president have told us, is because the real reasons for why we're in Iraq are not something that the American people would really get behind. So they needed something to get people behind them, which they did very effectively. I think it's an awful thing, and I probably would be just like most Americans in thinking, well, of course there are these linkages, and of course there are these WMDs. I would be just like everybody who thinks that in America, which is still the majority, had I not worked for Bill Luddy for those 10 months and actually saw what it is that they are doing and were doing and what was important to them and what was not important to them. And quite frankly, the truth was not important to them. It was whatever is important is what is the propaganda value. How does it fit into the storyline? How can it help the president and the vice president convince Americans that we need to do this thing? And they succeeded. It's this very sad thing.
And one of the organizations that appears to be full of neoconservatives and running our policy is the Defense Policy Board. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that's true. In fact, an interesting thing about the Defense Policy Board, in general, you never hear about the Defense Policy Board. I mean, you'd think that Rumsfeld thought it up, but it's been around for a while. But you don't hear about them because they're just kind of a bunch of old advisors and, you know, they meet occasionally and whatnot. And we heard a lot about the Defense Policy Board in the run-up to this war because Richard Perle was the chairman up until, I guess, March when he had to resign as chairman. He's still on the board. It's an interesting question I always ask everybody. I said, well, do you know who the current chairman of the Defense Policy Board is? Do you know?
No, I have no idea.
I wonder why nobody knows. It's Tilly Fowler, but I wonder why nobody knows that. Because nobody cares. Perle is doing his thing. Things are going on exactly as they were. Perle was the Defense Policy Board. Perle is responsible for Feith being in the position that he's in. And these people have an agenda. They have a long-term agenda. They've been working on it for a long time. There's plenty of papers out there that explain it. And it's amazing. The Defense Policy Board was part of pursuing that agenda. In fact, it's interesting, the membership of the Defense Policy Board includes Newt Gingrich, who has written a lot of articles and editorials and features and that kind of thing about what it is that they want. Another guy on there, I think Ken Adelman is on there, and he's been an active neoconservative writer. So, you know, the Defense Policy Board is almost like Goebbels' propaganda arm, the little machine of highly educated, highly articulate people to put forth a particular agenda and have it look as if it comes from different objective sources, and it doesn't. You really have to follow the people that are involved in this. And in fact, there was a neat article, Haaretz in Israel, the newspaper. They had an article not too long ago. It's fascinating, and it says the 25 people that make American foreign policy. I guess I'm not sure if that's the exact title, but they listed the 25 people that make the policy. And of course, if you look at them, they're you can go to the Project for New American Century and find most of the same names. You can go to the Center for Security Policy and find most of the same names. And you can go to a particular public affairs representative, Benador Associates, and look at their list of speakers. And it's the whole neocon crowd. So all these things come out, and it's just wonderful how they have been able to use the media to basically shape public opinion in a really masterful way, considering that 70% of people, 69 I guess, 69% of the people felt that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9-1-1. That is wonderful success in propaganda, because he had nothing to do with 9-1-1. And that is documented evidentiary proof, okay? That is there. The president himself said that. So as Secretary Rumsfeld and Undersecretary Wolfowitz have said that he has nothing to do with it. But why does 69% of American people feel that he did? It's a wonderful success of propaganda. And Americans are not immune to it. We're susceptible to it as any other people have ever been that you can read about in history.
You actually asked a question of Douglas Feith in a town hall meeting.
I did ask him a question.
About the Defense Policy Board.
Yes, I did.
What was his response, and what was the audience's response to his response?
Oh, the audience didn't have much response to
okay.
it. Well, I must say, there was a guy next to me who said, "You go, girl." But another Air Force guy who I did not know, and he kind of sympathized with me. What Mr. Feith did at that time was basically tell me a lie in front of a closed-circuit television audience, global defense audience. That was a town hall meeting for the undersecretaries. Policy was up there, acquisition of technology, budget, the whole crowd, and they were taking questions. And I asked him a question about the role of the Defense Policy Board, and did Mr. Feith, as the head of policy, did he find it difficult that many members of the Defense Policy Board were very outspoken and vocal in the media about particular policy initiatives that they'd like to see taken? And I said, basically, did you feel pressure? How did that affect how you do your job? Now, that was a loaded question, of course, and I knew it and Mr. Feith knew it. Richard Perle got Feith the job. And as far as I've heard rumors, that Mr. Perle keeps Feith the job. So, this was a loaded question on my part. At the same time, I think it's a legitimate question, and it reflected some things in the people have been talking about in the media. And he told me that the Defense Policy Board is a very nice group of people, and they take a look at things that we here in the Pentagon don't have time to look at. And he listed things like Central America, the Asian Rim, Canadian issues. He didn't use Canadian, but it was basically like that. Anything but Israel, Iraq, Iran, Syria, the Middle East, Lebanon, all this. Anything but that, okay? And, I'm looking at it, I'm just going, I'm glad that you're putting this on record, because here's one more example of Doug Feith. How do you know when he's lying? His lips are moving. Outrageous, just outrageous. It's amazing to me that they're so shy about admitting it. But I did ask him that question. He did lie to me and tell me that. And, I worked in policy, and, of course, I knew that when we had issues with Central America, Latin America, even China, we didn't go to Richard Perle and say, please solve this for us. Richard Perle and his people and Gingrich and all these neocons that sit on the Defense Policy Board were hard at work in focusing and shaping the agenda on not just Afghanistan, but particularly Iraq, because it is the heart of the Middle East. The way these folks look at how we're going to transform the Middle East, Iraq was the very first thing. And they've written to this extent. I mean, in the 90s, all through the Clinton era, these folks had written these things saying that this is how we have to do this. And they basically implemented their plan.
Well, I want to thank you for your time and your insights and comments and everything.
Okay.
It's really fascinating.
I'm glad you asked me on, and it's always fun to talk about these things.